And we will move on to our second case for this morning, which is Gonzalez against the Village of West Milwaukee, 10-23-56. Mr. Monroe?
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is John Monroe. I represent Jesus Gonzalez, the appellant in this case. He brought a 1983 action against two separate municipalities in Wisconsin and their officers based on two separate incidents that are...
Why were these cases properly joined, by the way? I see very little that justifies joinder under the federal rules.
Well, they were joined, Your Honor, because there were common questions of law, mostly, on whether it's proper to charge somebody with a disorderly conduct based solely on account of the person carrying a firearm.
So you keep saying solely on account of a person carrying a firearm, but when I looked at the record and saw what the manager at Menards said in the first instance, she was emphasizing that it was private property. So is it your position that in Wisconsin the right to carry a firearm openly also extends to the right to carry that firearm on somebody else's private property over the objection of the owner?
No, that's not our position at all, Your Honor.
Then why doesn't that rule at least eliminate your Menards case?
Well, the question isn't whether he was charged for some kind of weapons violation or even for a trespass violation.
You're trying to make the argument, though, that he has this unalloyed right to carry a firearm, and I would say what the alternative rule might be is that the facts and circumstances of the case make some difference. And you also have strongly urged that if we don't uphold your client's right in this case, then the Wisconsin Constitution might as well be set to one side. But it seems to me one could certainly have the right to carry a firearm out in the open in public areas or for hunting purposes or for anything. But if you're on private property and the owner objects, the police are allowed to come and take action.
I think that would be correct if the owner objected and the person essentially disregarded the owner's objection. This isn't a case, however, where Menards had a sign on the door, had an announced policy.
He's orally informed, and there's an altercation, and then he leaves and goes out to the parking lot, which I believe he's probably still in Menards' property at that point.
Well, actually, he was asked to leave. He protested, ultimately left, went out to the parking lot, and actually the manager only asked him to go out to the parking lot. The manager did not eject him from the property. The manager just said, "I wish you'd take your gun out and put it in your car." And he said, "I'm not comfortable leaving a gun in a car by itself." So the manager said, "Well, then you'll have to leave." And so he did. The manager did not eject him from the property. And in fact, his brother stayed and continued his purchase. And when the police arrested him, he and his brother were unloading the purchases from the cart into the truck.
I know. So the question, however, I think, is whether in either of these cases having an openly carried gun under the circumstances could at least give rise to arguable probable cause that disorderly conduct has been committed.
I think that's right, Your Honor. And in Wisconsin, disorderly conduct has a two-part test.
Right.
Neither the district court nor the appellees have pointed to how the first prong was satisfied. The district court actually even found that my client did not engage in violent, abusive, indecent, profane, boisterous, or unreasonably loud behavior.
Clause.
Then the residual clauses or similar conduct.
Right.
They haven't pointed any similar conduct. What he did.
You don't agree with his characterization of the similar conduct. I understand that.
I don't think they've articulated any. He carried a firearm, but But none of those are like
people.
This.
I mean, you know, there are all too many. I'm sure the Walmart and Menards managers were thinking about all the instances in which people have walked into stores and started mowing people down. You know, and you don't know what's inside another person's mind. So there was a great deal of consternation that the record reflects.
Well, I still don't think there's been an articulation of how merely carrying a firearm was similar to any of those particular conducts. I mean, there's been no attempt to compare it to any of the six enumerated.
It doesn't have to. It's a residual clause. It doesn't have to be exactly the same as. It's something that's creating panic in the store.
But it has to be something similar to those. Say, for example, a man in Middle Eastern garb boarded an airplane in Milwaukee and sat down and started reading the Quran. If people started becoming upset about that, the flight attendants went up and asked the pilot to eject him from the plane, and he did.
There's nothing he could do with the Quran that would kill people unless he really could hit really hard over someone's head.
No, but people...
A gun, however, could be taken. This was a loaded gun with a bullet in the magazine. A bullet was ready to be fired.
The gun was loaded, that's correct, Your Honor.
And it was chambered, right?
Yes.
So
although, of course, that was unknown to the police at the time.
That's quite different from holding a Quran, in my view.
But the point is, people might become frightened by the person on the
and
plane.
Clearly, that's not enough if there's nothing objectively reasonable about that. But a gun, loaded gun, is a much riskier thing to have around. And people are in a retail store. Again, to me, it's very important that this is in private property. I don't think we'd have the same case if he was walking down the street.
I guess in this instance, I don't see the difference, Your Honor. He was asked to leave the property, and he did, but he had no prior knowledge or warning not to be on the property.
They report to the police, though, that he's argumentative and disruptive before he leaves. He doesn't want to leave.
He didn't want to leave and put his gun in the car, and he told the manager that. And the manager said, well, then you'll have to leave. He did leave. He just didn't want to go put his gun in the car and come back and leave a gun unattended in the car.
Which is maybe what's in his mind. Let's move to Menards. Walmart. It's 11:30 at night, and he's in the store. They have the cash registers open. He's buying ammunition.
That's correct, Your Honor. For a different firearm.
For a different firearm.
Right. The manager acknowledged that when she called 911. He was not buying ammunition for that firearm that he was carrying. I think he was buying shotgun shells, and he was carrying a pistol.
So let me approach this from a different approach. Where is the clearly established law that should have alerted these officers that they should not arrest somebody in that situation, either the middle of the night in the Walmart or the disruptive person with a gun inside a busy retail store with the Menards?
Well, first you have the general...
What established law are you relying on?
First you have the general proposition that there must be probable cause that that a crime has been
correct.
Committed.
And that's way too broad for, as Anderson against Crichton says, you don't want to hold police officers personally liable for things that are in the course of development. They're not supposed to be law professors or lawyers or judges or whatever.
Right. And then secondarily, you have Florida versus JL, which held...
It's quite different, actually.
Well, I mean, there are different facts, but it still came to the conclusion that there's no Fourth Amendment exception, or there's no firearm exception to the Fourth Amendment.
And I don't think anybody has to say so, but Florida against JL is a case of saying, you know, I can't describe, you know, there's a man wearing a tie with red and blue stripes on him, I want you to come pat him down. Anybody could see that. There's nothing. There are many, many facts in this case, so I don't think this is really a JL problem.
Right. This is not an anonymous tip situation. There are a lot of firsthand facts at the officer's disposal here to justify the stop and then the arrest. The real question in this case is the interplay between the state constitutional amendment securing a right to keep and bear arms for Wisconsin citizens and disorderly conduct statute in this case. I mean, the disorderly conduct statute, the residual clause, has been applied in Wisconsin to everything from political protests that are otherwise peaceful and not, you know, unreasonably loud, et cetera, to student essays that threaten the teacher. So it casts an extremely wide net. So the real question here is the interplay between the state constitutional amendment as interpreted in Cole and Homden and this statute. And it seems to me you're looking for some sort of a categorical rule that in light of the amendment, the statute doesn't apply to this situation of open carry in a retail establishment. I mean, is that a fair summary of your legal issue here?
I wouldn't say a categorical rule, Your Honor. What our point is that if all the person does is just carry a firearm into a retail store or just out in public, if that alone is disorderly conduct, then there is no right to carry a firearm at all in Wisconsin, and that's not what the Wisconsin Constitution says.
Well, I understand that, but that question was left quite unsettled after Cole and Homden, and was, in fact, a substantial part of the state's defense of the carrying concealed weapons statute in Wisconsin in those cases. And there were, I don't know, how many separate opinions in those cases? Do you remember?
There were several. I don't remember how many.
Nine.
Okay.
Right. Every justice but one wrote separately. And how is that clearly established law?
Well, I think all of the, even the, for example, I mentioned Chief Justice Abrams' dissent said that, well, a person has a right to openly carry a firearm.
How many votes did that dissent get?
I don't recall one, I believe. But even the state, as you pointed out, even the state's defense was, but you can carry a firearm openly in Wisconsin. That was the state's position.
Right, but the majority of the court didn't buy it.
But if you can't carry a firearm concealed or openly in Wisconsin, then you can't carry one. And that
But that's where your logic is way too broad. To say that forgets that there are retail establishments, there are rural areas, there are urban areas, there are schools, there are courthouses. Certainly you're not saying that Mr. Gonzalez can come into this courtroom carrying a loaded, ready-to-fire weapon. I mean, there's a lot of subtlety to this area, whether we like it or not.
I recognize, especially under, for example, the Heller case, the Supreme Court found that or ruled that that the Second Amendment doesn't apply to certain sensitive places and mentioned government buildings, for example, which would include
That's
the building
That's only because the Supreme
Court
is operating out of a government building. Otherwise, it's not restricted to government building. You're seriously in your rebuttal.
I realize that, and I'll sit down. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Vitar.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Ramzi Batar. I represent the municipalities in this case, as well as Officers Young, Krivchek, and Donovan. Just to address a few points in response to the comments already made this morning, in addition to the Fisher and Cole case, you'll also want to take a look at the Fisher case, which came out a few years after Homden, in which the Supreme Court issued another set of divided and splintered opinions. So to say that the law in this area was clearly established is off the mark. There was nothing in the state of Wisconsin in the case law or administratively or anywhere that alerted these officers that what they were doing on these days at the Chilton Walmart, the West Milwaukee Menards, ran afoul of the disorderly conduct statute and violated the Fourth Amendment.
The Fisher case didn't settle the issue of the applicability of the disorderly conduct to open carry any more than Cole or Homden did. Is that the case?
That's my only point, Your Honor. I mean, the law is well unsettled in this area of the law, and that was three cases there dealing with the concealed carry statute and whether that was overridden by the right to bear arms. And in those cases, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said that the right to bear arms did not override, as a matter of course, the concealed carry law. It's completely different, but the cases came up this morning. I'm only offering you this third case just to show how unsettled the law in Wisconsin is. And there's
To the extent that gives your clients qualified immunity on the damages claim, there was a claim for declaratory and injunctive relief that was pleaded in this case. I'm not sure to what extent it was advanced, both in the district court on the cross motions for summary judgment or here. But qualified immunity would not apply to that form of relief. So do we have that issue alive in the case?
Well, I think qualified immunity is what actually governs this case and the arguable
for damages.
But that's
for damages. I would agree that qualified immunity does not apply to injunctive relief and declaratory relief, but we have to look carefully at the complaint. There was no claim for injunctive relief. If there was any type of claim for injunctive relief, it was maybe to ask the court to expunge the Social Security number, but that's it.
So that's what I was going to say. Is the claim for injunctive relief addressed only to the Privacy Act part of this case, or does it also apply to the Fourth Amendment part of the case?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. If you look at
it does. It's in paragraph 32 of the complaint, where the declaration with respect to the plaintiff's rights to open carry in
correct.
Wisconsin.
He's seeking a declaration, but he's not seeking an injunction in that regard. With respect to the injunction, my only point was that applied only to the Privacy Act claim. And on the declaratory relief, I don't know what relief there is to declare. This was a one-time incident in the village of West Milwaukee and in the city of Chilton. There's no likelihood of it being repeated.
Is that a standing argument?
I think it goes to standing. And I think that was one of the declaratory judgment issues were fully briefed in the district court below. I don't think that they were briefed very much before this court, but you could look at the briefing before the district court. And that was one of the arguments we made, that it's a standing argument, and he doesn't have standing to obtain a declaratory relief. At the end of the day, what this case is all about...
Meaning that there's no assurance that the police will ever respond again in the same way or that the circumstances... I guess that gets to a more general question I have, which is whether it's your position that it's always disorderly conduct openly to carry a weapon in a large retail establishment like Menards or Walmart.
That's not our position. It's not our position
at
all.
Something about this case that pushes it beyond that.
That's right. It's the additional circumstances, and there's a constant...
Could you review what those are?
Well, sure. In the West Milwaukee matter, for instance, he was asked, and this goes to the comments made earlier by Mr. Monroe, the owners didn't just simply object. They asked him three times to leave the store. If you look at Assistant Manager McCloy's testimony, the manager was nervous. He was afraid of his employees, himself, his customers. I think he testified that there was definitely a lot of adrenaline pumping, and he's conveying all this information to Officer Krivchuk. He's telling Officer Krivchuk what this man is doing is creeping people out. What Mr. Gonzalez did, both in the West Milwaukee Menards and the city of Chilton, a Walmart matter, was beyond what was usual. It was beyond people's everyday experiences. It made people afraid and nervous. And I think that was sufficient grounds for an officer to respond. They're not just responding to someone because he's got a gun in the store. He's making employees nervous. He's making the manager nervous. And when you
is there any significance at all to the fact that, you know, if you are sending threatening emails or if you're holding a Quran, it might take you a while to do something disruptive, whereas it's a matter of a split second with a gun?
Your Honor, I guess I'm here today to address what these officers did in this case. I think that's clearly different when you've got a Quran. A Quran is not, most people will not feel that a Quran is reasonably dangerous to them. In this case, we've got a gun.
Most people probably don't even know what one looks like.
That's right. I mean, the response, whether it's a Quran or whether it's a man walking into a store with a gun, is really going to be, there's only one of two possible responses. People are either going to shrug their shoulder and not object and think nothing of it, or in this case, people were upset. People were nervous. They communicated that to the manager, and the manager told...
It is a fair criticism of the district court's decision, though, that... it seemed to lay down a categorical rule that anytime anybody walks into a store openly carrying, it's disorderly conduct per se. And in light of the constitutional overlay here, we have to be concerned about that in the same way that we have to in First Amendment, the use of or the presence of First Amendment challenges to disorderly conduct prosecutions.
You're right, Your Honor. And you know, that was one of the points that, that plaintiffs made. But what they're really looking at is just one paragraph from the district court's decision. It's at page 6. It's in the middle of that page. They think it went too far. But the paragraph that that follows at pages 6 to 7 puts this matter in context. And that's what the, our position is here. You have to look at the context. You have to look at the facts and the circumstances and the reasonable inferences. And it may not be the same answer in a case with a guy with a Koran in the airport. But in this case, there was a disturbance.
So if he had walked into a small sporting goods shop with a gun openly displayed where everybody else is dealing with guns, too, maybe there wouldn't be any reason for disorderly conduct.
That's correct, Your Honor. But in this case, these officers were given information by trustworthy sources. You know, that's another reason why the those JL cases and the firearm exception, that's just all one big red herring in this case. These were trustworthy individuals. They were known tipsters, if we could call them that. They were accountable. They identified themselves. In the Chilton matter in particular, Officer Young, it's a smaller town. He knew the Walmart manager, Miss Fairchild. He approached her at the front of the store that day. She communicated what was going on in the store. They're trying to stall Mr. Gonzalez.
You know, I'm going to interrupt you and move to the Privacy Act claim because
sure.
time is limited.
Sure.
We have some legal issues on the Privacy Act claims under Section 7A and 7B here, and whether those sections apply to state and local governments as their text suggest. And then there's another issue about whether there's a private cause of action that can be vindicated in a Section 1983 action. And there's case law on both sides of both of those questions, so we need to essentially choose sides. But assuming we choose as the district court did, which is to say that Section 7A and 7B are applicable against state and local governments, and there is a private right of action. The lack of clarity in the law may provide your individual clients with qualified immunity for liability, but there is a Monell claim, as I understand this case, on the Privacy Act aspects of the claim, and it appears that West Milwaukee did have a policy of requiring a Social Security number in the booking process and not providing the warning in the case. Is that not clear from the facts?
Let me start with the end of your question, Your Honor. There was no specific policy governing the booking process. There's nothing in the record indicating there was a specific policy in that regard. What these officers were doing were following the booking cards that are presented by the FBI and the Wisconsin CSI. These are booking cards that they were following that asked for the Social Security number.
And West Milwaukee doesn't have a policy that implements those requirements of the booking cards?
I assume it does.
Otherwise, the officers wouldn't be using it, right?
Well, I'm sure that the officers may have had some kind of, there could have been a pamphlet that advises these officers as to how to fill out the FBI booking card and the state of Wisconsin booking card. But those issues were never really addressed.
Well, the officers
before.
Testified in deposition that this
he
was
did.
Part of the village's booking procedures, right?
That's right. He testified that he has Mr. Gonzalez sitting there. He's fingerprinting him. He's asking him for his name. And the booking information on these FBI cards and state of Wisconsin cards is also calling for a Social Security number. And whether it was the fingerprinting or asking for the Social Security number, Mr. Gonzalez didn't want to provide any of that information.
Right. No, I know what the facts are, but
right.
My question is, you know, whether there's a factual issue here for a jury on whether the village had a policy or practice within the meaning of Monell of requiring this as a part of its booking procedure, and not providing the warning that's required by the Privacy Act.
Quite frankly, Your Honor, it was a matter that was not fully developed or addressed by either party below.
Okay.
As I explained, all we have is a deposition testimony from Officer Krivchuk explaining I'm following these federal and state booking forms, and I just don't see how there can be a Monell claim when there, to my knowledge at least, there's no Village of West Milwaukee policy that says follow the FBI and State of Wisconsin booking cards. And, oh, by the way, if someone doesn't provide their Social Security number, you know, threaten them with something. I mean,
well, and let me just interject that, I mean, we have perhaps slightly separate issues with regard to sub A and sub B. The additional question for sub A is whether the terms right, benefit, or privilege encompass this kind of situation, or whether it's more like you can't get welfare benefits without giving your Social Security number or the like. And the question with respect to subpart B, that's the additional question, is whether subpart B creates the kind of individual rights creating language that Gonzaga against Doe calls for you to be able to sue. Even if we assume it covers local government agencies, can you, is the individual given a right under sub B? But if this wasn't fully explored at the district court, it's very difficult to take that much further.
Your Honor, you know, in this case, even in the briefing, plaintiff's briefing before this court, it's unclear what right benefit he believes he was denied. In the briefing here, he seems to say that it was a liberty interest. But that's quite a – first of all, I think that that's been rejected by this Seventh Circuit in the McElrath case that we cited, that the right to privacy is not one of constitutional magnitude. And then secondly, if we compare this cases even to the ones that plaintiff cites, like Dittman, that was a case where they threatened to take away someone's license. Another case was Ingerman. They threatened to deny someone benefits under a senior Easy Pass bridge program. And a third was Simecki, where they threatened not to return someone's property if they didn't provide a Social Security number. And I think that this case, that this court has a handful of cases, as Justice Sykes acknowledges, the cases are splintered, they're all over the place, but there's the Schmidt case, the Polkowski case, the Dittman case, and the Bush case, all of which found that agency does not apply to a local government, that there's no private cause of action. And I know that my time is almost up here, but I just want to draw your attention to a few key points that I don't think have come through in the briefing. If you look at Section 7, right before Section 7A and 7B, there's a purpose section for those Sections A and B. And in the purpose section, Subsection A and Subsection B both say that the purpose and intent of this these regulations is applicable to federal agencies. For instance, Subpart 1 says the privacy of an individual is directly affected by the collection, maintenance, use, and dissemination of personal information by federal agencies. And there's several places in the purpose section where it's talking about federal agencies. And I think the Schmidt case.
That's in Section 2.
Excuse me?
I think that's in Section 2, isn't it?
It's in Section 2 of the 1974 Privacy Act. I'd also point out that in the Schmidt case, the court did a pretty good job. That's a Sixth Circuit decision. It's only a few years old. It really hasn't been distinguished. Of course, there, as plaintiff has indicated, there's a few cases that go the other way, but the Schmidt case did a good job of pointing out the legislative history, and in particular at page 331 of that decision, the historical record shows that the bill was never meant to apply to local and private organizations.
Okay, you're going to need to wrap up at this point, Mr. Bitar.
So the point we'd like to make on the Fourth Amendment, Your Honor, is that we're not asking for a categorical bright-line rule. Plaintiffs seem to be looking for that. That's not what this case is about. It's about what the facts and circumstances were. And on the Privacy Act claims, we don't think that they apply to the local governments, and we don't think that they can be pursued in a Section 1983 action.
Okay.
We would ask for a dismissal of the complaint, just as the district court did.
All right. Thanks very much. Mr. Monroe, anything further? And I'll give you an extra minute because we went over a bit.
And I have a question right off the bat. I'd like you to address the issue of the claim for injunctive declaratory relief and to what extent it was pleaded and developed in the district court and in this court.
Are you talking about with respect to the 1983 claims?
Yes, setting aside the Privacy Act claim for now.
Okay. Yes, we did plead declaratory and injunctive relief for the for the 1983 claims. In fact, that's the primary relief sought. I mean, clearly there are not a lot of damages at stake here. It was a brief detention in both cases. The primary relief sought is the declaratory and injunctive relief.
To the extent that that was preserved, then, isn't there a standing problem?
I don't believe there is, Your Honor. Mr. Gonzalez lived in the community. In fact, he has revisited those stores, at least the Walmart store, I believe, wearing a firearm. I mean,
no problem?
With no problem whatsoever. Walmart has no
problem. So why is there an active case
actually,
or controversy?
I'm not sure that helps you.
Right, if he's actively exercising his right to openly carry in these same establishments and in these same communities,
but
then there isn't any realistic prospect of injury.
No one called the police in that instance. But if they called the police, there's no reason to believe why exactly the same thing wouldn't happen again.
There may be another problem with standing. In this case, there is a homicide prosecution pending against Jesus Gonzalez in Milwaukee County Circuit Court, first-degree intentional homicide and an attempted first-degree intentional homicide pending trial in February. Is that your client?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
And he is under a disability as a condition of his bail that he cannot possess firearms?
That is currently the case, Your Honor, yes.
So there's another impediment to standing. He's got a separate impediment to his possession of firearms, whether openly concealed or in any other way, because he's under a bail condition not to?
That is currently the case, Your Honor. That's true. That wasn't the case, of course, when we brought the case or when the district
right,
court made its decision.
Right. We have to evaluate standing as we go.
I understand. Let me switch to the Privacy Act for a minute. When you're talking to Mr. Bitar, you said perhaps the individual defendants might have qualified immunity because the law may not have been clearly established. Just to point out, we did not seek damages in the Privacy Act claim. That is only a declaratory and injunctive relief claim, so there would be no application of qualified immunity in that claim. Judge Wood, I also wanted to address your concern about private property. I don't know whether Menards actually has a policy or not. Certainly in that case, they asked him to leave. Walmart...
And mentioned private property.
Pardon?
And the manager actually talked about private property. It's not just implicit.
Right. In the Walmart instance, there was no interaction between management or employees and Mr. Gonzalez. They never asked him to leave. Walmart does not have a policy against... I mean, what their policy is, people can carry firearms in their stores consistent with state law. So even though that's private property, the private property owner in that case doesn't have a problem with it. So I just wanted to point that out to you. If there aren't other questions, I can sit down. But.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.